Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Adam Kokesh. He is a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are an Iraq veteran. How did let's talk about why you enlisted in the first place and when.
I enlisted in 1999 in the delayed entry program during right after my junior year of high school. So I was in the DEP for 1 year, and I went to boot camp June 18, 2000. And I joined the Marine Corps, and I joined the reserves because I was going to college. I had it all paid for. That wasn't a motivating factor for me, but rather I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to have my life on the line for something I believed in. And it meant something for me in that vein to be a member of the Marines, among the first to fight, and to have a combat MOS. That's why I joined.
And when did you first get called? Were you first called to Iraq? Was that your first active duty?
Well, boot camp and Marine combat training and field artillery school, but I actually volunteered to go to Iraq. And just as a little bit of background, I was against the war before the war. I went to the one day of student walkouts in February 2003, you know, and that was kind of the high point for the anti-war movement, when people thought that the powers that be were actually listening before they were dismissed as a focus group by the president. But I was against the war because I didn't think it was going to be worth it. I still believe in the lies of Colin Powell and all of the propaganda. It just didn't seem like it was going to be worth it. As someone who believes in a foreign policy of non-intervention, you know, I just didn't see the value for the United States. And being a Marine, I think I had a better sense of the cost than most people. But after the war, I'll say I fell for it again. I believed the storyline that we were being fed, and that what we were doing in Iraq was cleaning up our mess and trying to do good by the Iraqi people and really responsible foreign policy. So you can say I was anti-war, but then pro-occupation. But in that vein, that was something that I really wanted to be a part of. And so I actually volunteered to go, and I was really excited to go in civil affairs, actually.
What did you do in civil affairs?
Well, I got activated 2 weeks before we deployed, having actually made my first phone call a few months earlier and been like, hey, you know, because I found out that they were calling for volunteers to go in civil affairs since our artillery unit wasn't getting called up. And I was thinking, you know, a ready-to-go Marine would have been snapped up once they started calling for volunteers, but it kind of got lost in the shuffle at that point. So I got activated 2 weeks before we deployed, and I learned that what we were going to be doing in civil affairs was shaking hands and kissing babies and working with Iraqi contractors and working on schools and mosques and clinics and water projects and all that good stuff that sounded exactly like what the president was saying we were going to be doing on TV. And in that sense, I was really excited. I thought we were going to be leading the charge to rebuild Iraq. And that was something that, you know, back then we all were enthusiastically risking our lives to accomplish.
And so what happened when you got there?
Well, I found out it was really a different story. We were six-man teams attached to regiments or battalions, you know, large infantry units. And you couldn't go anywhere where we were in the Fallujah area without a convoy of a minimum of six Humvees with machine guns. So we had to beg these infantry commanders to get out and do our missions and to tag along on their convoys just to get outside the wire, you know. And we found ourselves constantly struggling with them to justify our existence. And we came up with a slogan: we care so that you don't have to. And to the macabre Marine Corps sense of humor, that was pretty funny.
Yeah, right.
And in that situation, it was perfect. It really captured our sentiment. But it's pretty easy to step back and see how messed up that is.
Were you there during the sieges of Fallujah?
I was there for the first siege in April, yeah. I was attached to Gulf 2-1. We were at Rock ASP, which is a little ammo supply point where American contractors were destroying Iraqi munition stores. And that was between Camp TQ, Takadum, and the city of Fallujah. And then we got called up for a mission that we didn't know what it was. And they said, pack for 3 days. You know, have your convoy staged and ready at midnight. And so we got out there, and then we got our convoy briefing, and it was, all right, we're going to Fallujah. We're setting up the blockade on the perimeter, you know, on the on the western side of the city over the Euphrates at the two bridges. And I was like, oh, crap. let me go grab some more underwear and cigarettes. You know, it was like, we're going to be there for more than 3 days. But we didn't even get that chance. So we got out there in the middle of the night, and we set up the blocking positions, or rather the engineers attached to us did. And as a civil affairs team, they didn't know what to do with us for a while. So I was in that first siege for 18 days of combat. And then we were pulled out to set up the Civil Military Operations Center outside the city, the FLT, or Fallujah Liaison Team. Only in the military, or only in the Marines, can a facility be called a team. But, you know, as we say, if it made sense, it wouldn't be the Marine Corps.
We've had both Jeremy Scahill and Dar Jamail on this program talking about Fallujah, but you were on the inside. What did you see? I mean, obviously, it's a longer story than we can tell right here, but...
Well, I had a distinct perspective, and I've heard a lot of Dar's stories from, you know, during or after the siege, from inside the city, and to hear that perspective, that other side of it that I thought was there but didn't know for sure, like, that was really mind-blowing. You know, it's an incredible perspective that Dar Jamail is able to share. But
that's amazing that he saw things that you didn't when you were inside the military.
Right, of course. Well, because he was inside the city, and, you know, like, he saw as the convoy was leaving after the siege, you know, when we had that big joint convoy that was supposed to be the great celebration of the setup of the Fallujah Brigade when we handed over security to the Iraqi forces there. That was to see, like, that after, as soon as the Americans drove past, you know, there were celebrations that they were leaving the city. There were people in the streets, like, openly cheering about that, and that's one of the things that he talks about. And, you know, I kind of had a sense of that, but I wasn't able to see that from where I was, you know, on from within the Marine Corps, you know, from where I was at my Civil Military Ops Center, where everybody was coming to kiss our butts to get money and other favors and whatnot, or from where I was in the siege when we were on the peninsula. And, you know, I saw that the worst thing for me was that we decided we were going to escalate some of the fighting, and before doing so, we were going to be magnanimous enough to let out women and children from the city. But if you think about it, you know, this is a city of over 250,000 people, and you're telling families, because for us, like, I actually ran the checkpoint for a short period of time on the what we call the Brooklyn Bridge, where the Blackwater security agents had their burned bodies strung up. And our guideline was any male over 14, you have to turn back. You know, if he's old enough to be in your fighting hole, he's too old to get out of the city. And so we were giving families a choice, you know, either stay in the city and stay together and risk having a round from a C-130 gunship dropped on your head, or split your family in half and the women and the small children can leave, but with nowhere to go, and, you know, leave the older men behind and have them risk that. And
what did people choose?
Well, there were actually only a handful that left the city during that time. After the siege itself, when we had the sort of loose cordon around the city over the summer, a lot more people were able to get out as complete families. But during that siege, when we were dropping C-130 Spectre gunship rounds, artillery rounds, into the city every day, you know, we were giving people that choice. And there was there was no preparation for it or anything to accommodate them. At my checkpoint, what we were doing was saying, there's a mosque across the street, you know, good luck, and sending the women and children off that way with, you know, most of them had nowhere to go.
So how long were you in Iraq?
I was there from February to September of 2004, so 7 months.
I've often thought that if what the United States really wanted to do, which they've often paid lip service to, namely build democracy in the Middle East, they would have done precisely what the civil affairs people were supposed to do, namely rebuild infrastructure and water projects,
right,
and mosques and so on. And they just didn't do those things.
Well, there was some of that on a, you know, I mean, we did that. We actually got a chance to do that on a small scale locally. But what would have strategically made the mission at least more true to the rhetoric that was being used to justify it would have been having the infantry units attached to civil affairs instead of the other way around. Instead of us being the adjunct, we care so that you don't have to, people, having the civil affairs be really the focus of the mission.
Right.
And there were some people that got that there. And there were a few there was one infantry captain who was responsible for security around Camp Fallujah who really understood that. And he did his best in the cities, the small villages around Camp Fallujah, to make the spirit of civil affairs at least the focus. And he actually used his infantry command to do that and did a pretty good job, but I mean, given the circumstance. But I realized during my time there the futility of that, that as much good as we were able to do for people locally on a very small scale in the scope of the larger occupation, it was really futile because, you know, they don't need rule. They don't need all of these things to get what they really need, which is rule of law. And a single Iraqi cop, corrupt as he may be, with an AK-47 strung over his shoulder with a boot lace, you know, has more effect of creating rule of law in a small Iraqi village than an entire platoon of Marines. Even if they come through once a day, which is rarely the case, they, you know, send up a cloud of dust that you can see coming from a mile away, and they set up a perimeter and walk around within their 100-meter perimeter, and they ask people, have you seen any bad guys lately? And, you know, they can stop the bomb makers from setting up shop on the street corner, but the only thing that they're really able to do consistently is piss people off and make targets of themselves. And, you know, I realized that futility of us providing security, that was just an absurd fallacy, that we were imposing martial law, you know, and there's no way to attain any kind of real security in that situation. But it's also absurd to think that we have all these standards like, oh, well, they don't have electricity. We have to stay until they have electricity. Well, America had a functioning democracy for quite a while without electricity, if I recall. Yes. You know, there have been flourishing civilizations throughout the world long before electricity was around. So to try to say that by any of these standards of, you know, modern quality of life, you know, that we have to attain those for the Iraqi people under a system that has no security, you know, is absurd. You know, let the people provide security for themselves. Let them establish a rule of law that's suitable for their communities and their societies instead of imposing our idea of martial law. But having realized this about halfway through my tour, I fell back on the rationalization, at least we're keeping the fight off American soil. And as soon as I came home, I realized that that was BS too, because we're making enemies faster than we can kill them over there. But there's a great attempt to avoid that cognitive dissonance, because I knew that no matter what went on in my head, the next day I'm going to have the same mission and the same orders and the same consequences if I don't follow them. Now, that never even occurred to me consciously, but it was easier for me to shift rationalizations, as we're doing as a country, as our leadership is doing, to justify what's going on there instead of facing the reality of what's going on. And as Iraq Veterans Against the War, we take that as a huge part of our responsibility. It's using our experiences and our realizations to cut through that and cut through the spin.
We're speaking with Adam Kokesh, member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So what was the process of kind of ending that cognitive dissonance when you came home? I mean, what happened and how did you get involved with Iraq Veterans Against the War?
Well, like I said, it was a gradual process for me. Coming home and then realizing that that was a fallacy, that, you know, providing security or keeping the fight off American soil. And what I would have said when I came home was, we need to cut troop levels by at least 75%, restrict ourselves to training, support, logistical support, maybe security of key facilities at their request, and the continued diplomatic support for the political process. But what that would mean is that the occupation would end. We would stop controlling their intelligence agency, would stop imposing martial law, would stop controlling their resources, you know, that kind of thing. And I never vocalized it that way, and I never really spoke out, and I never realized the significance of the power of speaking out as a veteran until after I got out of the military. And I actually volunteered to go back, and I got in trouble for having brought a pistol back the first time after I got activated. So I sat at Camp Pendleton for a year as a sergeant mowing lawns, taking care of a barracks. And then got out of the military at the end of 2006. I moved to D.C. to get a master's in political management, and I came across the IVAW website. And I just was like, Iraq Veterans Against the War. Well, that's me. And I had no idea what it meant to be an anti-war veteran. You know, I was... When I thought about the tradition of soldiers coming home and sharing their experiences, it never occurred to me that that was something I could do, or that that was something you could do to really bring about positive change in the world. And when I saw the website, it was just like, I got to have my name on this list. I have to be a part of this. And next thing you know, I'm a full-time activist.
So you went from being a Marine to being an activist. Were you supposed to go back to Iraq at some point? I mean, did you were you called back for another deployment?
No. I volunteered to go back and then got in trouble and then got out. And then I was in the inactive reserve, and they came after me, excuse me, for protesting in uniform for doing something called Operation First Casualty. When we did a mock combat patrol through the streets of D.C. to give the people a taste of what it's like to live under the occupation the way we're doing it in Iraq.
Which is a really great action to do, because I think people just have no idea what it would be like. I mean, I was thinking in Santa Fe, if you had hundreds of soldiers from Nigeria or China marching down the streets of Santa Fe, how would we feel?
Yeah. And it's really tough, but if you go back and think about it, like, I joined the Marine Corps at the age of 17. And if I was in Iraq and I was 17 right now, I mean that for the last 5 years now, my country has been run by a foreign occupying force. And that before that, it was under economic sanctions for a decade. And, you know, I would have been 2 years old when that started.
Right.
And, you know, I might have had a twin brother that died because he didn't get the medical attention or medical vaccines or whatever that he needed because of those sanctions. And, you know, if I saw Canadian tanks rolling down the streets of Santa Fe, you know, I know what I'd be doing. You know, and I'd like to think that if I was in Iraq, I wouldn't be taking up arms against the American troops there. But I know whose side I'd be on, you know. And I think it's, you know, I was a psychology major in college. So anytime, you know, I see a behavior that appears irrational, I try to think, what is the conditioning that has led to that? And if you just, and I kept that in mind while I was in Iraq, because every time we saw something like that, everybody would throw their hands in the air and start cussing out all the Hajis and say, oh, you know, these people. And it's like they're people just like anybody else. You just got to step back and think about the conditioning that they've been subjected to by their circumstance. And it's no surprise that they turn to violence as the only answer, that they're going to be violent towards the Americans there, and they're going to resent that presence. You know, like I said, I know from my education that that's not the best thing for them to be doing, that it's not right for them to kill Americans there. But, you know, I know that if I was in that situation, just knowing who I am, being subject to that conditioning, like I said, I know whose side I'd be on.
So as an activist, part of what you are doing is communicating with other Americans who are perhaps pro-war at this point or confused.
There's
about
still
the
a few of them.
There's still a few of
There's
them.
There's a lot more who are confused than for it.
So how do you communicate with people? What kind of issues do people really want to talk about? Where does the confusion lie?
Well, we're not so concerned about the American people in general, except those that really want to help us be proactive and take direct action to end the war. And we've decided as Iraq Veterans Against the War that the most effective way that we can work to end the war is by withdrawing military support. And our strategy is based on the concept that all power structures are inherently unstable, you know, and are supported by various pillars that maintain those power structures. You know, for the Iraq War as a power structure, you've got, you know, political support, media support, financial support, corporate support, political support, but most importantly, military support. And if most of that's complicit because people join the military and, you know, don't realize the implications of their actions today when they join the military, that they are really supporting the occupations. And we've decided the most effective way that we as veterans can bring an end to the war is by helping withdraw military support. And so there's three ways that we do that, or rather three levels at which we do that. And the first is in counter-retention. And it's really tricky because, our theme is breaking the cycle of dependence. And
so explain what the word counter-retention means.
Counter-retention, just helping people who are facing the pressures to stay in the military get out and know that they have communities of people that will care about them, respect them as veterans, and that they'll get the care that they deserve. And that's tough, but you know, this administration is doing everything they can to deny the cost of this war, including denying funding for the VA and all that proper health treatment. So, but also we have stop loss, where troops are being involuntarily extended to be sent back to Iraq or Afghanistan. And there's a big re-enlistment push for the troops that are in country. And what they'll tell you is, well, your unit's getting stop-lost. And you can go home, get stop-lost, and probably be back in Iraq anyways. Or you can re-enlist for 4 years and get a $20,000 enlistment bonus. So it's like, you're screwed either way. But one way, you've got $20,000. So that's why re-enlistment is actually doing pretty well by the numbers, because they've re-engineered the game in such a way that, you know, people are more inclined to put their to re-sign the papers. The next one is in supporting GI resistance, and that's really huge. And most people don't realize that the reason Nixon was forced to withdraw ground troops from Vietnam was because the army was at the breaking point. Officers were getting fragged. Whole units were refusing to go out on missions. Drug use was rampant. Good order and discipline didn't exist in the troops in Vietnam.
How does that compare to what's going on in Iraq now?
Well, it's, you know, they say we have an all-volunteer army, you know, except for those that are stop-lost involuntarily, of course. So that it's not as – people aren't as prone to say, hey, screw this because I was drafted. But we're starting to see a lot of it. And the most prominent example is in search and avoid missions. And that's, of course, a parody on search and destroy, where a whole unit, instead of going out and doing what they're supposed to do, they'll go sit out under a bridge, and, you know, where they won't get hit by mortars, and you know, call in some fake situation reports and say, yeah, we set up a checkpoint, we didn't find anything,
right,
whatever. And it's gotten to the point now where there's a certain tacit understanding between insurgents and the troops that are doing that in some areas. And anytime like a convoy of Americans parks anywhere, you know, they're approached by Iraqis. And you put park under an overpass, you know, Iraqi kids will come up to you and try to sell you soda or whatever. And so they're actually using the kids now to pass notes to the effect of, don't mess with us and we won't mess with you. So already we're starting to see some of that. The number of AWOLs and desertions is skyrocketing. But in what it means for us to support GI resistance is really important. Because for those guys who are in the military, who are in Iraq, or back home, who just came home, who realize that the war is criminal, that to put soldiers and Marines in those situations that they're being put in those occupations is criminal, that they don't want to be a part of it anymore. It's like being in a building that's on fire and not knowing what floor you're on and not knowing how to get out, but you just know that you have to get out. And all you see is a window. And to jump through that window takes a certain courage. And we have to be there as a movement to show that we're there to catch them when they jump out of that window.
So you're encouraging people to desert?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If they think that they are going to heed the call to their conscience over orders that are immoral, we support them in that.
And have you had a lot of people doing that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, that's different than malingering for personal reasons.
Right.
And in that sense, we don't support those who just say, yeah, I can't take it. I want to get out of this. But those who actually recognize that it is immoral for them to follow their orders, it is immoral for them to be a part of these occupations, those, we support them. And we, like I said, we need to make it clear as a movement and as veterans too that we are there to support them. And to help provide access to veterans' benefits too is a huge thing for them to know that when they come out, you know, that they might still have access to that, or that they'll have help with that, or that as a community, like we're doing something now called Homefront Battle Buddies, which is a comprehensive mental health services program for IVAW that is available to all veterans, to show that, you know, we're not waiting for the government even to provide these benefits that they've promised, but we're taking it upon ourselves as a community of veterans to take care of each other. And so that's a huge part of that. But also there's the publicity support for when people, you know, have the courage to resist. There's the logistical support, the moral support. And the moral support in this case really is significant, because these people who have that courage are essentially turning their backs on an institution that they've been completely dependent on, and that they will face repercussions from, and that they will face moral harassment or emotional harassment from. And so for them to know that they're people that respect what they're doing is really huge. The third level in which we are withdrawing military support is in counter-recruiting. But more specifically for us, is truth in recruiting. And by sharing the truth about our experiences and what it means to be in the military today with people who are considering joining, we're hoping that those things can change. We're not like, I'm very pro-military. Within the movement, I'm very pro-military. And you know, I like there to be a world someday where it's not necessary for the United States to have a military at all. But right now, the general concept of what we have as a military is what we need to defend ourselves. And I wholeheartedly support that. But there are certain things about it that are so corrupt that they can't continue. And when we say to someone who's going to be recruited that or considering joining the military, that when your recruiter tells you, I can promise you won't go to Iraq or Afghanistan for whatever myriad of reasons that can come up with, that they have no say whatsoever in what actually happens to you. You know, we're hoping that that will change. We're hoping that either the recruiting has changed in such a way that people actually have contracts when they join the military. Right now, you get in an enlistment document.
It's not a legally binding contract.
Exactly.
So when they say
it's only
you're
legally
in for 4
binding
years,
to you,
right.
Which is why they kind of this is why they're getting away with
really,
the stop loss
policy.
They're
taking it. They have it both ways. So it's legally binding to you, but not to
right,
them.
Right. It's a unilateral contract.
Wow.
So it does not bind the government to anything. There's clauses in there that specifically say that, you know, so such and such and such and such may change at any time without any notice to me, you know.
And so you try to let young people, the way you were when you were 17 years old, know what they're really getting into.
Right. Well, I thought that I knew what I was getting into, and for the reasons I joined, I don't regret having joined. But being in the military today means something a lot different than what it meant in 2000.
Right.
Unfortunately. Not that it was perfect in 2000, but there's a lot of other things that we share. And for example, they'll say that you'll get great job training. Well, only 12.6% of women and about 5-7% of men report ever using skills learned in the military directly in their civilian life.
Is that right?
And it's messed up because they'll use that to recruit you. And then when they're trying to get you to reenlist, they'll say, when you tell them, well, I'm going to go get a civilian job. So what? You can't do that. You got no skills, no training. You're 4 years behind all of your peers. You've been a trigger puller for 4 years. What are you going to do? You know, you got to reenlist. You go be a janitor. Come on. And so they totally flip that on you. Now, if another thing is that, you know, they say that the military, you know, the GI Bill is touted as a great recruiting tool, and it's something that a lot of people enlist for, but a very small percent actually use. All the money that's available to them. It's under 10%. And if sharing that truth convinces so many people to not join the military that they have to change that truth, that means that by us sharing the truth of our experiences and the truth about military service, we are forcing that reform. You know, we're trying to reform the military. We're trying to make a military that is not used for illegal occupations and a military that does actually respect the rights and promises that are made to service members. And so that's really our goal of truth in recruiting. But the main thing, of course, is in ending the war. So that's just the last way that we are actively working to withdraw military support.
We're speaking with Adam Kokesh, member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So this coming weekend, March 13th through 16th, there is a Winter Soldier investigation, and it's taking the same name as the 1971 Vietnam War.
Right.
Time,
well,
Winter
it comes
Soldier.
From the quote from Thomas Paine, right. Of course, from 1776, The Crisis, when he said, "These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will in this crisis shrink from his duty. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman." And the tradition of winter soldiering is something that is very dear to us as patriotic Americans. And it's something that's been going on throughout our history, from the Bonus Army to Smedley Butler to Vietnam Veterans Against the War and their Winter Soldier investigation in 1971, in which they had a very specific purpose. And it was to demonstrate that the My Lai massacre was not an isolated incident, but rather the inevitable result of the occupation, or rather the policies that were being carried out in Southeast Asia. And now,
and that there were just uncountable numbers of My Lai massacres.
Right. Now, that was a little more specific in that they wanted to show that there were other atrocities and war crimes being committed. That's not so much our purpose with Iraq Veterans Against the War, Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, but rather to complete the picture for the American people about the occupations and to really show the inevitable results of that policy.
You know, what's actually going to be happening in D.C.?
Well, we're going to have over 100 veterans over 200 veterans come together and nearly 100 that are going to be testifying to their experiences. But they're going to be testifying, like I said, to complete the picture for the American people. And it's not just to show that, you know, Haditha and Hamdaniyah and Abu Ghraib and Fallujah, where I was, aren't isolated incidents, but rather the inevitable result of this policy. And it's not – we're not trying to say that incidents like that happen every single day or are commonplace, but the factors that lead to those are pervasive, and that no one should be surprised that these things happen with the situations that soldiers are in, and that, you know, smaller incidents that are similar, that are based on the same factors, happen every single day in Iraq. And to really, like I said, complete that picture, because we've heard from generals on the ground who have made it clear that they care more about their careers than the truth. We've heard from the politicians with their various agendas. We've heard from the media, which it's disgusting to see that they would rather cut and paste a Pentagon press release than do any real investigative journalism. And we've heard a little bit from the troops on the ground, and it hurts me a little bit to say this, to admit this, but you can't expect to get any a good, accurate picture from them either. Because from my experience, especially in civil affairs, which was a somewhat high-profile position over there, we were coached on what we were allowed to say to the media. And it was basically, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And there's a lot of not nice things that need to be said about what's going on there in the texture of the everyday and, you know, what it means to have a footprint there as an occupation, as we describe it. You know, what it means to patrol, you know, how that really affects the Iraqi people, you know, and to, like I said, complete that picture for the American people.
What does it take for people to start telling the truth instead of doing the policy that you were saying? If you don't have anything nice to say, don't speak.
I don't know. You know, for me, it was just a gradual process of realization. And I hope that by my speaking out and, you know, all my brothers and sisters in IVAW speaking out, that other soldiers will see that and have the courage to face the reality of what's going on and take their experiences and put them to good use to actually, you know, work to bring an end to the war. And it's not that it's any great act of courage necessarily, but it is rare, you know.
So, well, how are, for example, the people who are speaking in the Winter Soldier investigation in this upcoming weekend, these are people who are already willing and able to really speak out, I take it.
Right.
And so how are
Well,
their
actually,
words?
We have some people who are coming to testify who have never spoken publicly before. Mm-hmm. There are some stories being told. There are stories that I'll be telling that have never been told publicly before. So, you know, there's and we're organizing it in panels to address different themes. So there's going to be one panel on convoy operations. There's going to be one panel on rules of engagement. There's going to be a panel on sexual harassment and discrimination within the military. There's going to be a panel on treatment of detainees. All these things that the American people have this sort of, you know, mythological or iconic concept of, but, you know, that's really distinct from the reality that we want to share.
So how are we able to – how's the rest of the country that's not in D.C., that's not there in person, able to hear it?
Well, we're going to have it live streaming on the internet. It'll be live broadcast through Pacifica Radio. But if you go to IVAW.org, India Victor Alpha Whiskey, .org.
Or Iraq Veterans
Against
the
War. .org. There's plenty of information there on how you can see the actual testimony streaming live online. Of course, there'll be clips up on YouTube almost immediately. There'll be lots of media coverage and lots of links on there. But a lot of people have been asking me, like, oh, well, how do I get tickets? You know, and that's not really the point of the event like this. And unfortunately, due to the logistical concerns and some of the security concerns, it's actually a closed event. But that's one of the great things about the technology that we have today and being able to share this globally now in real time. So we're going to be what we're asking people to do is to take advantage of that and use it as an outreach tool. Use it to build your organizations. Use it to grow the movement. Use it to grow understanding in your communities. And instead of just coming to see it, have a viewing party. Get 10 people who otherwise wouldn't have given Iraq a second thought, who really just have that kind of, you know, iconic concept of it, who don't really know the reality, who don't know any veterans who are coming home and speaking out. Get them involved. Let them know. Use it to show your kids, you know, and it may be tough. But it's really important as an educational tool to let people know, let students know what's going on in the world, especially high school students who are being painted a very different picture by recruiters who are convincing them to enlist than veterans who have actually been there.
I'm wondering about the whole free speech aspect of this. I mean, I was looking at your blog, and there are even sections on your blog that have been redacted.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That was about a case putting up posters in Lafayette Park in front of the White House in September last year. And myself and Tina Richards, who's the mother of a Marine of two tours who's 80% disabled, were putting up posters for an upcoming event and were arrested for defacing public property. And it was clearly a case of political harassment, when what we were doing was distinctly legal based on the code that we have from, you know, DC municipal regulations. And we were acquitted, but there was someone else arrested that day for picking up a bucket, Ian Thompson, who's a wonderful organizer who works with the LA Answer Coalition, which is Act Now, Stop War, to End Racism. Excuse me, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. And they were actually hosting the event that we were promoting with those posters. And a police officer had grabbed a bucket and put it down on the sidewalk, and he went to pick up the bucket. And the police officer went and grabbed him by the arm and had him put down the bucket, and he cooperated and was arrested and got arrested and was charged with assaulting a police officer and found guilty. And so there's still
for
some
picking up a bucket.
Yeah, and there's still it's absurd because anything by the code, anything that you do that impedes the actions of a police officer and their duty is considered assault of a police officer. So by picking up a bucket that he had put down that he didn't even announce but didn't want anybody to touch, he was convicted for assault, and he's awaiting sentencing right now. And what I had done is posted on my blog some of the stuff that I had said about what had happened that day in court. And the judge had come down and talked to our attorneys and said that we can't be talking about that stuff while it's still going on, or that that she was upset about me saying how absurd it was, that, like, as a condition of my release originally, that I was not allowed to poster anywhere in D.C. Which is like, you know, you're not guilty of any crime. At least you haven't been found guilty. But as a condition of your release, we're taking away this aspect of your First Amendment rights. You know, and by criticizing that, or after criticizing that, we got a letter from the court. I haven't seen it yet myself. My lawyer has it. But when your lawyer says you need to redact this from your blog because it may have legal repercussions for a friend of yours in their sentencing, you know, you don't question that.
Right, right.
And it really sucks that we're, you know, living in such a fascist state when we're under the thumb of people like that. But that's the reality of it, and we're faced with those tough decisions.
Well, and I wonder with the Winter Soldier, are people are going to say all sorts of things that the government's
right.
going to want to
Absolutely.
Censor. Do people have to censor themselves, or they're just going to say it? What do you?
Well, there are certain realistic or very real security concerns in terms of not compromising the troops that are on the ground today. And, you know, we're pretty careful about that. And we're not going to do anything that would compromise the troops on the ground because, you know, if anything, we're the ones that have their back.
But, I mean, they, you know, did you ever see Valerie Plame's book? They redacted
right.
half of the book. I mean, they redacted parts on breastfeeding.
Right. Well, it's – well, you're going to see quite a storm afterwards. But there are already armies of well, I shouldn't say armies, but there are a handful of crazy right-wing bloggers now doing everything they can to discredit us before we've even had the event, calling us fake veterans and, you know, like I said, doing everything they can to discredit us. But the testimony will speak for itself once it's out there. And one of the things that they're saying is that if any of us are falsely representing ourselves as veterans, that we need to be prosecuted under the Stolen Valor Act. And we're saying absolutely. In fact, we've been telling people who are coming forward to testify, if you deliberately mislead us, we will prosecute you or recommend you for prosecution under the Stolen Valor Act. You know, we totally support that. We think that, you know, your service as a veteran is sacred, and that the people who falsely represent themselves as veterans should be prosecuted under the Stolen Valor Act. Well, the reason we put that out there actually, though, was because some of these groups that are opposing us have said that they're actually going to send in infiltrators pose as fake veterans in order to discredit us. We're doing everything we can to ensure that those who are testifying have all the paperwork to back up their testimony and corroborating accounts. Like I said, the testimony will speak for itself.
Will there be a film edited? The Winter Soldier film from 1971-72 mm-hmm. was just a masterpiece of filmmaking. It was very moving, very well done. Are you going to do something
Absolutely.
Along those lines?
In fact, if you've seen Sir No Sir, which is a wonderful documentary about the GI resistance in Vietnam that David Zeiger did, David Zeiger himself is now going to be doing the documentary for this Winter Soldier. So very excited about that. Looking forward to that. We've had a I run the DCIVAW house, and so we've had a camera person living with us for the last couple of weeks. It's been pretty crazy. It's nice to come home to Santa Fe and not have to worry about someone like over your shoulder with a big camera 24 hours a day.
So you're from here, born and raised?
Not born and raised. My dad moved out here while I was in high school, and I finished my last few years of high school here. And this is where I enlisted. I enlisted right here on St. Mike's.
And have the mainstream media picked up on the Winter Soldier, upcoming Winter Soldier event?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got commitments from a lot of major media outlets to cover it. But I have a good friend of mine, Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who's also an Air Force chaplain veteran and president of the Hip Hop Caucus, as he likes to say, the revolution may not be televised, but it will be uploaded.
That's where we're at right now.
Exactly.
Can you read the tattoo on your right arm?
Sure. It says, for those who fight for it, life has a special flavor the protected never know, USMC. And that's actually from Vietnam. And the legend is that it was from Quezon and was written on a sea rations box. It was being used as a bunker brick. And the Marine that wrote it went off and died in combat. And it became kind of a trendy thing to write on your flak jacket in Kevlar and on the walls of the latrines out there. And so it entered into Marine Corps lore when a lot of guys brought it back. And I saw it when I was 14 years old. I went to Devil Pups Junior Boot Camp at Camp Pendleton. And I came home and I was like, Dad, I got to get this tattoo. And he was like, no, you don't. So after I joined the Marines and I was at artillery school, I decided that, you know, well, now I rate it. And I rate the USMC tattoo, so I'm going to get it.
It's interesting. The protected never know. It's, you know, there's a lot in that. You fight so the protected never have to know. But here you are making sure that the protected do know.
Well, I never really thought of it that way. But for me, it means that for those who fight for it, and that has a double meaning because it can refer to the special flavor that life may have or life itself. And if it's fighting for life itself, it means that those who are playing at those stakes, for those that take it upon themselves to fight for life, for those that take it upon themselves to fight for what they believe in with their lives and put their lives in line for what they believe in, you know, they're living on a whole other level. And those that protect themselves from that, those that isolate themselves from truly living their full potential, are the ones that will never know that.
Adam Kokesh, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And just one more time, if I may, for your listeners, please take the message of Winter Soldier. Help us spread it. Help us use that to bring about some positive change. Go to IVAW.org for all the information about how you can find out about that. And for more information about myself, I have a personal blog too, as you mentioned earlier, and that's Kokesh, KOKESH.blogspot.com.
And once again, IVAW.org. And from the 13th through the 16th, you can actually watch live the Winter Soldier investigations. We've been speaking with Adam Kokesh, member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You're listening to KSFR. I'd like to introduce Catherine Davis with the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me. It's nice to see you again.
Yes, so to speak, since we're on the phone. So you have a big event coming up that we want to just let people know about at the Center for Contemporary Arts.
We sure do. It's the 12th annual fundraiser Beaux-Arts Ball, and we're calling it Cirque du CCA this year.
That means you're going to have contortionists?
Well, it means that we're all going to be wearing masks and crazy hats and costumes and just enjoying sort of a carnival atmosphere. And there possibly could be contortionists. You just never know about these Santa Fans.
And so tell us a little bit about the Center for Contemporary Arts. It's one of the longest-running nonprofit organizations in Santa Fe that's gone through many metamorphoses.
It certainly has. CCA has been here since 1979. So we will be celebrating our 30th anniversary next year. We're looking forward to that. And CCA is essentially Santa Fe's destination for contemporary arts and film. We definitely are known for the Cinematheque, where Jason Silverman, the curator, has been running fabulous films for such a long time. And then, of course, we have a very strong visual arts program that Cindy Kahn is the director of. And we are also running, only recently started, a digital media or digital arts media program with classes, and Martin Back is running that, and he's just doing an amazing job. So we've got a lot going on.
And the way you keep it all running, besides charging admission for tickets, is mm-hmm. events like the Beaux-Arts Ball, which also happens every year, but it seems like it's really different every year.
Well, the last few years we've had some date changes as CCA has gone through some of its metamorphoses, as you've noted. So we have had some date changes. It used to happen around things or Halloween, but we've noticed in the community, and since we're a really community-based organization, we don't want to compete with anybody, as we noticed that other organizations were holding events around Halloween. We thought, well, you know, let's kind of find a time when there's a lull and fill it. And so it's this March 15th that we'll be having the Beaux-Arts Ball. And
the Ides of March.
The Ides of March, yes. And it's going to be a really exciting event. I mean, we have DJs, we have visual pyrotechnics, we have
Pyrotechnics. Does that mean fire jugglers?
I have no idea. I'm excited to see what's going to happen. The entity is the person who's doing it is called Hypothetical Entity. He's our VJ, and so he calls it visual pyrotechnics. I think it means that there's going to be a whole lot of lights and all kinds of crazy things going on visually as well as aurally, as well as sound-wise. So you can dance and stare and eat and drink. Tsuki Village Market is providing us with a martini bar.
Mm.
There will be lots of good wines provided by Susan's Fine Wine and Spirits.
Anything else happening?
Yes, I wanted to be sure and mention the fact that we're going to have live auctions. At the event on Saturday night, you could bid for things like concert tickets and airline tickets to Dallas to see Bruce Springsteen, Tim McGraw tickets, a walk-on role in a movie by Lionsgate Films. I mean, all kinds of wild and wacky and wonderful things.
And the ubiquitous and inevitable Santa Fe Silent Auction.
Silent Auction by your favorite artist. So you can go online to ccasantafe.org and start your proxy bidding now, or you can show up at the event, or we hope that you'll start bidding now and show up on Saturday evening. So we want to thank our artists who are participating and everyone who's donated amazing things, floral arrangements every month for a year, tickets to the Cirque du Soleil's Beatles Love, I mean, spa and hotel gift packages. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
And is this all happening at the CCA's building?
At the CCA in the Munoz Waxman Gallery, which is the old tank storehouse. I don't know if you know the story about that, but
no.
They used to store tanks down here. I think the only tank garage in the state.
Like tanks, like military
like
tanks.
Military tanks.
Are there any tanks left?
Up the hill from us at the Bataan Memorial Museum. I think there's still a tank. I can't remember.
And so this is all on Saturday, the 15th of March.
Yes, from 6 to 11.
From 6 to 11.
Uh-huh.
Well, Catherine Davis, thank you so much for letting us know about all this. And,
you're welcome.
For joining us for these few minutes on KSFR.
And we hope to see you there, Mary Charlotte.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's all.
Did we cover enough? Okay.
I know. Do you think we covered enough? You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Thank you.